Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries. They cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Welcome to The Food Scene. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Jim Peterson of JimCooks.com, also known as James Peterson, lauded cookbook author of over a dozen, 14 books now?
15, actually.
15.
Mm-hmm.
Are you counting the re-release of vegetables?
No, I'm not.
I wasn't going to let you cheat on
your numbers. I know. Yeah. No, I'm not counting that one.
Yeah. And what's your most recent one out?
The most recent one is Kitchen Simple.
Yeah. And that was about what?
That was about cooking like everybody, you know, writes a book about 30-minute meals. Yeah. I had to write mine.
Yeah.
So it is. It is that. It's stuff that's not incredibly original, although some of it is.
Yeah.
But there's stuff in there like creme brulee, but I do a touch where I put berries on top.
Yeah.
I serve it. A big one. I make one big one. I cover it with raspberries when it's all done. And then I serve it at the table by scooping it out. So it's dramatic.
Yeah.
But it's still simple.
Yeah.
It's just as simple as making the plain one.
Yeah. But it's for sharing. And let's call it 29-minute meals. Undercut all those 30-minute meals
by one minute. That's a good idea. Yeah. I wish I had known that.
Efficiency.
Thought of that.
U.S. efficiency.
Beat all the other books out.
But, I mean, cooking simply harkens back to your days of growing up. You grew up in Northern California, which was kind of a bastion for, well, obviously, NorCal cuisine. What was happening when you grew up in that area?
Well, when I grew up, it was dead. It was pretty dead.
Yeah.
San Francisco was always well known for its restaurants. So we used to occasionally go to San Francisco or to Fisherman's Wharf for restaurants. But by our standards now, those restaurants weren't really innovative.
Yeah.
They hadn't caught up on the Alice Waters thing yet.
Yeah, but I mean, you must have been surrounded by amazing produce and markets. And was your home chock full of the food that you see at Grand Army Plaza and cook now?
No, it wasn't. My mother used mostly frozen vegetables.
Yeah.
And now that she's dead, I can talk about
it. But you had to be hushed for a while.
She got very, I heard her feelings once.
Yeah.
I wrote an article in Gourmet Magazine. And it was about, and I was describing how in my cooking classes, there are those who grew up with an ethnic cuisine.
Yeah.
Usually Jewish or Italian or Polish or something where they have a real context for cooking.
Yeah.
And then there are the rest of us who grew up eating Cheerios and that kind of stuff. And I just said I was among the latter group. Well, that didn't fly at all. What she said, what's next, Mommy dearest?
Yeah. So, from frozen vegetables to what? What was the transition to cuisine? I mean, you grew up in North California surrounded by it, but you didn't experience it there.
I didn't discover it till I went to France in 1975. I worked my way around the world. I went from San Francisco to Japan, and then I worked my way west.
From Asia to Europe,
which is unusual, but most people went the other direction.
Yeah.
But I went that way and ended up in Paris, and that's what just blew my mind.
Yeah. Why did you go to Asia and work your way to Europe? Because you didn't originally go to school for cooking. You were, what?
I was the chemistry major at Berkeley.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I decided to go around the world. Well, I wanted to find a guru in India.
Yeah.
That was part of the plan, which didn't work out. It was interesting. It's paradoxical, or it's ironic that I was looking for some direction in my life and found it in a way that was completely unexpected, which West. Was cuisine.
Yeah.
And it was in Paris. It wasn't in India.
Yeah. So when you arrived to Paris, I mean, did you take trains? Were you by foot? Did you
hitchhiked.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That must have been an experience in it of itself.
That was something. The interesting thing about hitchhiking in Europe, or in France especially, is that a whole different type of driver would pick you up.
Yeah.
In this country, it was hippies and long-haired guys. There, it was mostly women.
Yeah.
Women, people with families, all unexpected people. And it was always the best. The best people were always older people because we could talk cuisine.
Yeah.
And my French was so bad, that's all I could talk about anyway. But no, it was a real interesting experience hitchhiking.
Oh, cool. So what was the common cuisine that you could talk about? What were the dishes or foods that you were eating on the road?
Well, I would stop and eat, I'm trying to think what I remember eating. It was interesting because I would hitchhike to these great restaurants.
Yeah.
There was Ferdinand Point, there was Bocuse and those places, and I would hitchhike or sometimes take the train to those places.
Yeah. I mean, would you specifically say, hey, I want to go to Ferdinand Point's place, I want to go to Bocuse's place?
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming Michelin was based on people driving around, so they probably knew the directions already.
Yeah. So I would hitchhike or, as I say, occasionally take the train. But on the way, I would go to lesser places to eat. And that, in a way, was more interesting because it gave me more of a sense of what people were really eating there.
Yeah.
So I'd have things like crudités. That was a totally enlightening thing.
Yeah.
To have salads, an assortment of salads based on single vegetables.
Yeah.
Which was what was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
It was wonderfully delicious and nutritious.
Yeah.
And then things like civet de lapin or civet de lièvre, you know, hare stew,
yeah.
Or things like that that are harder and harder to find.
Yeah.
But real country cooking.
Yeah. So you get to Paris, or actually you worked in southern France at a point too, picking grapes.
Yes. Yeah. At one point in 1975, I arrived in Paris. I had no money.
Yeah.
Didn't want to go back to the United States yet. So I got a job picking grapes with this family near Carcassonne.
Yeah.
And that was enlightening because the mother would make us these fabulous lunches.
Yeah.
And they were really fabulous. I mean, we'd have pâtés and cheeses and, of course, a main course and something like tuna.
Yeah.
Which in those days, people didn't eat tuna in this country unless it came out of a can. We forget.
Yeah.
You're younger than I am, but I remember the 70s in America. And
yeah.
It was a desert.
Yeah, I don't. I was born in the 80s.
Yeah.
But you could have just said that you were a young soul. I mean, no, we're on radio. No one can actually see.
Gray hair.
I was going to say tweed jacket.
Oh, my tweed jacket and my gray hair. Yeah. I don't fit in this environment at all. They looked at me funny coming in the place.
You created this environment for them. Don't let them forget. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right.
But so not wanting to leave Paris, having to go down to the south and, you know, pick grapes. Did you return to Paris then or did you come back to the
States? I went to Italy.
Yeah.
Then I went to Italy and spent, I don't know, a couple of months in Italy. Which was magnificent. And in fact, I've just been transcribing my letters from back then. I saved all my letters that I had sent to my family. They saved them, and I'm transcribing them. And I just was at the part where I was in Italy. And the thing that struck me is how cheap things were.
Yeah.
I'd have pizza for $1 or a bottle of wine for $2, a real Chianti. You know? So things were very cheap relative to what they are now.
So did you stay in Italy for a while? Did you try to travel more around Europe?
After Italy, I went to Switzerland to see a friend, and then I went back to France.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was pretty much done. It was November, it was turning cold, and I came back to the United States.
Yeah. So with all that new, magnificent and fantastic new outlook, knowledge, tastes in Europe, you come back to the U.S. and become a short order cook of all things. Where were you working and why that position in the kitchen?
Well, I got a job washing dishes.
Yeah.
That was all I was qualified to do. I didn't have any qualifications. So I got the job washing dishes, and then I said, you know, I can cook.
Yeah.
I couldn't, but I said I could, and I could figure it out. And I discovered that I was good at working in a kitchen, a restaurant kitchen environment where there's that requirement for speed. I was good at that.
Yeah.
So eventually I used those skills combined with finer cuisine, and those skills paid off. They were really helpful.
So you had the speed, dexterity, and then eventually went into the technique.
Eventually I learned better cooking.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I returned, I thought I have to learn. I was inspired.
Yeah.
And I discovered this is what I want to do for my life's. This is my passion.
Awesome. So gaining some of that, you know, insight and ability, you end up going back to France.
Yes, I saved this shorter cook money. It's amazing because in those days, the salaries, money, you could make enough doing a job like that. And if you were really, really careful and pinched your pennies, you could actually save money to do what I did, which was to go back to Paris the following year.
Yeah.
And I went to see Richard Olney.
Yeah.
Because I had read, Alice had told me about his Simple French Food, the book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, who's Alice?
And Alice Waters, I'm sorry.
A good person to know. And how did you get in touch with Richard Olney, who's on French Cooking is absurdly amazing?
Well, I found out about him again through Jeremiah and Alice, Jeremiah Towers and Alice. And because they were reading his book, and it was impossible to get out of the library because they kept... It was out of print.
Yeah.
I finally got my hands on it. And I remember coming home on the bus, the Muni bus in San Francisco, and reading it and not putting it down until 4 that morning.
Yeah.
It was like a novel.
Yeah.
It was so exciting, his take on food and his sense of creativity and improvisation, all based on traditional French food.
Yeah.
So I thought, I've got to meet this guy. So when I went to Paris... That summer, I think it was summer of 76, I went and I hitchhiked to the south of France, and I ended up at the base of his hill. He lived on the top of a hill in this little house, little shepherd's house, I think, originally. And I was walking up the hill, and I could hear the typewriter, so I knew I was in the right place. And I get there, and he's seated in an arbor in front of his little house. There's an arbor with grapes and all perfectly idyllic and everything. And he's stark naked. And he stands up and he takes this little Speedo bathing suit that's hanging off the trill and he puts it on and he says, "Allow me to receive you." So he made lunch for me. We had grilled a salad mesclun, which was the first time I ever had something like that.
Yeah.
I was blown away. And a grilled fish with some fennel and basic Southern French cooking. It was magnificent.
Yeah, just so simple.
So simple.
So straightforward, but, you know, based in such steep tradition.
I think what inspired me about all of this was wine.
Yeah.
It was really wine that, was learning about wine that carried me into cuisine. My interest was initially more in wine than cooking.
Yeah. Do you remember that gateway bottle, that one that transitioned you away from Carlo Rossi and the jug to...
Oh, I remember the first Sauternes I ever tasted.
Yeah.
In those days, this was 19, you know, 7, whatever. You could buy a bottle of Sauternes for $3 because no one knew what it was.
Yeah.
So when I tasted that the first time, I was just, oh my gosh, this is Sauternes. I was used to the stuff in the jugs that my parents drank. And then the first time I ever had a German Mosel, say nothing of Burgundies.
Yeah.
I was... And then, well, I'm jumping ahead, but after I came back from France again, I became kind of the cook in my wine group.
Yeah.
So I would cook and we would drink these fantastic wines that now are inaccessible. You see them at Christie's for auction.
Yeah.
Like Chateau Petrus. I mean, we would drink that.
Yeah. Were they VDPs at that point? I mean, were they accessible bottles without... designation, is that why they were cheap?
Oh, no, they were Appellation Contrôlées.
Yeah.
They just weren't well known. You could buy a bottle of Tosh for under $100, wow. Well under $100.
Yeah. See, it's so out of reach now. Do you think that actually is hurting cuisine at a point, being that, well, ingredients too are expensive, but wine or specific wines that, you know, cuisine was founded on?
Yes, I think you have a point.
Yeah.
I think it takes something away to have those wines inaccessible, those great Burgundies, to at least once in a while. People now, to have a Montrachet from the Domaine de la Romanée Conti, people, yeah, that's inaccessible. People aren't going to ever get to drink that. I got to drink it once.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate, the wines I was able to drink in my life. I'm very grateful that I drank when I did.
Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, back in France, a man named George Blanc.
Yes. Well, I asked Richard, where should I go to learn cooking? He said, well, I have two restaurants for you. One is Le Vivera in Paris.
Yeah.
And the other is, which was then Chez la Mère Blanc, which is George Blanc's restaurant. It used to be his mother's. It was one of those restaurants in Burgundy that are all the Mère something.
Yeah.
And they've been in the family for centuries. So it was one of those places. And I was hitchhiking there, and I met this young woman, and we hitchhiked there together. And I ended up having a meal there, and I remember having a breast chicken that had been poached in cream and served with fresh tarragon. Well, now that sounds, it could never be prosaic, because we can't get anything as good as a breast chicken here.
But, yeah.
But the idea is sort of simple.
Yeah.
But man, that it was like hearing a violin sonata or something and thinking, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This is revealing. This reveals a whole new world to me.
Yeah. So did you work for George?
I eventually ended up working. I worked at both those restaurants.
Awesome.
I hounded them.
Yeah.
Until they let me work there.
Yeah.
In those days, they had no program for stages. Now they have programs where you sign up and pay money, I think.
Yeah.
To be a stage.
Now you're just annoying to the point of them accepting you into their kitchen.
I just begged them. I wrote letters, and Le Vivera was crazy.
What was it?
Well, it was a 3-star restaurant at the time.
Yeah.
And I think it was the most inspiring for me because the level of the ingredients was so high, and the degree to which we did things at the last minute was so intense. We filleted fish to order.
Yeah.
We would clean chickens. In those days, you had to clean the chicken, pull the lungs and the heart and everything out. We would do that to order. So it was that, the cuisine was that, he was that much of a maniac.
Yeah, so eliminating mise en place almost completely for...
In a way.
Yeah.
The mise en place was were tubs of cream.
Yeah.
Big buckets of creme fraiche from Echelet, that really good from the Loire Valley.
Yeah.
From that area. And butter.
Yeah.
Which we used in huge amounts.
Wonderfully copious.
Oh.
Yeah.
It was a wonder anyone got out of there alive. But boy, was that food good.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and show that you actually made it back to the States in one piece. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Jim Peterson and a bucket of cream. So we were just in France. We're coming back to New York. This was during the 80s when you actually returned to, is it open up or just work at Le Petit Robert?
Well, after living in France for those 2 years, came back to New York in 1979. Or I shouldn't say came back to New York. I never had lived in New York. I lived in California. But in those days, there were no restaurant opportunities in California. As hard as that is to imagine now.
Yeah.
There just weren't. There was Alice and that whole tribe. And if you weren't in with them, you were nowhere. It was completely Alice Waters sort of kingdom.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I want to be independent and such. So I came to New York. I had a good friend here. So worked my got used to that. And then this man whom I had worked for in Paris opened a restaurant in the Village and asked me to come in as a partner. So I ended up actually being a restaurant owner before ever really working around in the United States very much.
Yeah.
So that I had that restaurant for 4 years.
And that was located in the Greenwich Village, where?
It's where the Spotted Pig is.
Oh, yeah.
That's the space.
Yeah. And what did you try to bring to the U.S. that you didn't think was here?
French cooking that was authentic, that wasn't just the rehash, Sol Véronique, and all the things that people had then that were just cliches and badly executed. And I wanted to take traditional French food and refine it, not alter it, not make it Japanese or anything like that, but just treat it like I would treat it if I were in a 3-star restaurant.
Yeah.
Cook a rabbit as though I were in a 3-star restaurant. So I tried to do that to make the food as good as possible.
And you said tried, and it was open for 4 years to really amazing accolades and praise. At what point did you step away from the stove and focus yourself on books?
Well, the restaurant closed. It was just a pile of things going wrong. My partner and I were at each other's throats, and the health department was on us, and we ran out. Our lease ran out, so we decided to just close the shop.
Yeah.
And I was at loose ends. I didn't have any money or anything. I had to get a job. And the French Culinary Institute approached me and said, you know, here's the thing, 5 hours a day. I thought, well, this is good. And I enjoyed teaching. I discovered that because I was training staff at the restaurant. And I enjoyed that. So I started teaching at the French Culinary Institute. And that suited me well.
Yeah. And you taught cooking.
Cooking.
Yeah.
But after being there a couple of years, I started to get bored again, which is the big story of my life. I get bored and then things have to change. But they needed someone to write curriculum because they had modeled the school after a French school, and there was no written curriculum for a lot of the courses. So for a year, I holed up in an office and wrote curriculum.
Yeah.
And that's how I started writing.
Yeah.
And I also was translating books. I had been approached by a publisher to translate these pastry books from French into English. So that was my connection when they said, well, if you ever want to do your own book, let us know. And I went, ding.
There it is.
Because I had always wanted to do a sauce book.
Yeah. I mean, classical French foundation technique.
With modern sauces in it.
Yeah, yeah.
That were not written down anywhere at the time.
It came out in 91. What were those sauces that didn't exist in any other publication?
Well, and everything that had been written up to then, the sauces did exist in other publications, but they weren't systematized.
Yeah.
Like, when I would encounter reduced cream, say a reduced cream sauce, those aren't very popular anymore because they were just kind of But when I would encounter that, I realized, well, this is analogous, if it's, say, based on broth, this is analogous to a classic velouté.
Yeah.
So I just took classic cooking and said Nouvelle Cuisine is really just a slight tweaking of classic cooking.
Or
not slight so much in the area of sauce making. But anyway, I try to put it in the sauces in context.
Well, I mean, aside from context, you put them in flowcharts, which I don't.
Flowcharts, right?
I don't think I had actually seen before in cookbooks, you know, because you always have these explanations. You always have, you know, have these things on hand and do these techniques. But to see some kind of visual, like moniker of how to break down classes of sauces and how to, you know, deviate. If you want to go this way, you can go this way. Just giving yourself permutations or options was kind of eye-opening for me.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad those were helpful, those charts. Yeah.
And in 91, the book itself, again, to big acclaim, won a James Beard Foundation Award.
Yeah, won Cookbook of the Year. I was blown away.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that award existed.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there. I won the award for my category. I was thrilled. The publisher's thrilled. My agent's thrilled. Everyone's thrilled. And then they announced with this final award, which is the Cookbook of the Year. I never, oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, some big name's going to win that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to win that. And there it was. It came up on the screen. And I just absolutely was mind-blown away.
Yeah.
And that changed. That really got me going. Because then I could get a book contract again for another book and keep going. And one led to the other. So
I mean, you base yourself on a lot of single subject books. Fish and Sailfish. There's the Simply Soups book. So you had a mode, almost kind of how you broke down your, you know, sauces. You had a vision of where you wanted to go. When did photography join itself in the cookbook?
Oh, you're running through my whole life. This is good.
Yeah.
This is a rehash.
Yeah,
I'll write my memoirs after this.
So if anyone asks a question about, you know, so what have you done in your life? Just send them this way.
I'll send them the tape. Well, the photography came about, oh, I guess 1993, 94, something like that. And I was just sitting up on my roof deck one morning, daydreaming and thinking, I had been on a shoot with Maria Robledo, who did the cover for my first edition of Sauces.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Big old camera with a bellows and it looked all very intriguing.
A cape.
And a cape, a black thing. It was the old-fashioned way. So I just thought, and I started reading. And when I become monomaniacal about something, which is the way I am about, I take one thing at a time, and everything else I forget about.
I was trying to be nice by saying single subject, but monomaniacal.
Monomania is more the word for it. And so I started reading everything I could read, and I bought a 4x5 camera and started shooting Polaroids and 4x5 chromes and just have kept at it. And it still challenges me. It's still very hard.
Well, it was the Fish and Sailfish book. Looking to photograph step-by-step similar or improve on Jacques Pepin's La Technique that you really wanted to start photographing. Now, how did you set yourself up? How did you mise yourself out for photography at that point?
Well, I had an apartment that was big enough to handle it. And I actually rented a studio up in Massachusetts, of all places, which was kind of a stupid thing to do because we couldn't access the fish. I was driving back and forth.
Yeah.
But I had a friend up there who was a food stylist, so anyway, that one thing led to the other. But we did the how-to pictures for that, and then the beauty shots up there. And the how-tos, there just weren't how-tos about fish like. Maybe Jacques Pepin had some.
Yeah. But, I mean, they were black and white. They were systematic in a different way. You were bringing new light to
They weren't sexy.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were good. I learned a lot from Jacques Pepin.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, when I was teaching at the French Culinary Institute, they'd wanted me to truss a chicken in that elaborate way with all the skewer, you know, and twist it back. I never can remember how to do it. But stuff like that, I quick look it up in Jacques Pepin.
Yeah. So, cookbooks. You know, you've done 14 of them. You've won numerous awards from the Beard Foundation, IACP. We're here today because you've actually just re-released one of your classics, Vegetables, which was published, 14 years ago?
Yes, 14 years ago.
Over 100,000 copies sold. So
isn't that amazing? It amazes me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it doesn't amaze me. And this is why, because I already have, you know, your first edition, now second edition of the cookbook. I have Sauces. But there is something new about vegetables. There is some, you know, renaissance about cooking with vegetables. But what was kind of amazing to think about is all the new vegetables and all the new techniques and the introduction of ethnic cuisine. I mean,
yes.
There was such an expanse that, you know, you put into these volumes. What were new vegetables? What were new techniques? What were new dishes that you introduced?
Well, there were, it's hard to remember exactly the dishes, but there was a lot more Asian influence.
Yeah.
And I realized that the other one was very Eurocentric.
Yeah.
And that's my background. It's still Eurocentric to a large degree, but less so.
Yeah.
So in terms of new techniques, not a whole lot. What I did do to the book that I think is a big improvement is I reorganized it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you you remember the old one, how it was all kind of done by type of dish.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted an artichoke, you didn't know quite where to go.
Yeah.
You had to look it up in the index. And now the techniques and everything and the types of dishes are all up front.
Yeah.
And then the vegetables are by alphabetical order.
Yeah. Do you think that's partially because we cook so much more seasonally now in the U.S.?
That's largely part.
Yeah.
And the experience of photographing it was magnificent.
Yeah.
Because we started in March, and my assistant and I, we followed the season. We went to the Green Market twice a week.
Yeah.
Union Square. And we followed the seasons until October.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So everything in there is right out of the ground that day, practically.
Yeah. So anyone that's doing a seasonal cookbook should really take a whole year to be able to go through the annual progression.
Ideally.
Yeah.
And my assistant later told me, she said it was like a spiritual experience for her.
Yeah.
It was this whole rebirth. I don't know how she phrased it, but it was important to her.
Yeah. So let's go from the spiritual to the technical. The camera that you shoot with, you're a Hasselblad man.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of backs do you use?
What kind of digital backs?
Yeah.
One's a Leaf, which is outdated now. It's only 18 megapixels, which is no big whoop. But at the time when I bought it, that was huge.
Yeah.
And then an Imicon, which is Hasselblad's own brand.
Yeah.
I just had it repaired for $1,700. These things break you. Photography is so expensive.
Expensive. I mean, your baking cookbook, how many rolls of films did you shoot on that?
Oh,
now,
well,
that's
we bracketed.
Yeah.
We bracketed. There were at least three shots per shot.
Yeah.
So, oh, gee,
thousands
I don't know
upon
how.
Thousands. I mean, obviously there is an overhead in digital once you have the equipment, but acquiring it is that much more expensive than analog.
Yes.
Do you still shoot film?
No, yeah. I haven't shot film in a while. Although I have nothing against it, and
yeah.
I'd love to break out the 4x5.
Yeah,
but digital's to be able to see it on the screen, I hook it up to the computer, so I see it immediately on the big screen.
Yeah,
that's just so much easier.
Yeah,
and it lends to carelessness. When I look at the baking book, I think I had to anticipate there couldn't be a crumb, there couldn't be a knife put in a weird position. It all had to be just right.
Yeah.
And now I just click and I look at the picture and you got to move the knife.
Yeah.
I'm lazy.
Yeah.
Lazier.
Well, it's kind of like the difference between, mise en place and a la minute, almost.
A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely an a la minute type.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's your next monomaniacal cookbook coming out?
Well, I'm working on a couple of ideas.
Yeah.
One is an idea about doneness, showing people when food is done.
A friend of mine always jokes about British cookbooks pretty much just end with, and cook until done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
and people say, my editor pointed this out, she said, people who don't know how to cook, their stumbling block is, I just don't know when it's done.
Yeah.
That's what people say.
Do you feel like people undercook or overcook more often than not?
Probably overcook.
Yeah.
Chicken and fish. Chicken is, they kill chicken. Chicken and turkey, birds.
Yeah.
Birds, they wreck.
Yeah. So how do you tell? I mean, from a visual standpoint.
Well, that's the rub.
Yeah.
Because not all cues for doneness are visual.
Yeah.
So it has to be written, and the descriptions have to be worked in when it deals with smell or touch.
Yeah.
So a chicken, for example, well, a chicken is visual. Because I look at the juices that form in the cavity, and they go through three stages, and I can see when they're ready.
Yeah, what are those three stages?
It goes from cloudy to clear with streaks of red to clear.
Yeah.
And people always say cook it till clear.
Yeah.
I say cook it till clear with streaks of red.
Yeah. Why?
If you cook it till clear, it's overdone.
Well, because of carryover heat or because of...
I don't know.
Yeah.
And I say to people also, and this is a mistake I've made, because when I cook a chicken, it's pink near where the thigh joint joins the breast,
yeah,
the back. That area, it's not raw, but it's pink. And the only other person who cooks this way I've heard of is, who's the famous Spago guy? Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah.
He does that too. But in any case, what were we talking about? I forget what we were.
Doneness.
Oh, doneness. Right. So anyway, I look at the juices.
Yeah. Interesting. What are there, you know, I mean, you named poultry, fish is, you know, absurdly tough.
Tricky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people.
Yes.
But vegetables, are there any vegetables that people just cook way past the point?
What? My bete noire is not over vegetables, it's undercooking.
Yeah.
String beans.
Yeah.
I like a string bean to be cooked.
Yeah.
So there's that slightest perceptible crunch.
Yeah.
But barely perceptible.
Yeah.
And people, I eat them, they're raw. It's like, chew, I got to chew these things. This is not how they're meant to be.
Yeah.
So I'm a little old-fashioned about the cooking times on vegetables.
Yeah.
I think some vegetables benefit from long cooking.
Yeah. It was funny. I went to Sicily, and we had a lot of green vegetables cooked affogato. Which means drunken, and many people know, you know, scoop ice cream, espresso on top. But these vegetables were cooked past the point of recognition, almost like baby food or puree. They were delicious. They were absolute, yes. But it really is a point of view kind of thing.
Yes, yes. It's like what's the vegetable I went in about? There was a vegetable, broccoli.
Yeah.
People always just blanch it or steam it.
Yeah.
And it's just boring as can be.
Yeah.
But if you stew it a little bit with garlic and olive oil and maybe a little lemon at the end, you get much more aroma from it.
Yeah.
Much more perfume.
And that is in your vegetables book?
Yes.
And that is a book that everyone should run out and get.
Absolutely.
First
immediately.
Edition. This second. We're
this
timing
second.
You. I said, Jim, James, Mr. Peterson, thank you very much for being on the show.
Michael, thank you so much for having me.
Looking forward to the next single subject cookbook.
Great.
And many more awards in the future. And now I'm going to go get a bucket of cream. Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.